great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about the importance of fungi in our world. To start the show, we have the author of a new book. It's called Entangled Life, How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Future. Merlin Sheldrake is a biologist and a writer with a background in plant sciences, microbiology, ecology, and history and philosophy of science. He received a PhD in tropical ecology from Cambridge University for his work on underground fungal networks in tropical forests in Panama, where he was a pre-doctoral research fellow of the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. So as we talk with him, what would you like to know about the relationship between fungi and nature? I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Merlin Sheldrake, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Oh, I'm not hearing Merlin. Oh, we're having a little bit of trouble getting him on board here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about his book while we fix this. Do we have it now? Merlin, are you there? No, he's not hearing me. So I'll tell you what, let me tell you about the book a little bit. I was completely gobsmacked, I think, by this book. It is it's a fascinating look at fungi, and when I finished the introduction that he wrote, which is 20 pages long, I thought to myself, you know what? That is worth the entire price of the book, because there are so many things in the book that surprised me right in that introduction that surprised me about fungi. And I, let me give you an example. He writes at some point that fungi produce 50 megatons of spores every year. You know how much that weighs? Well, it weighs, it's the equivalent of 500,000 blue whales. And I read that and holy cow. There are fungi found in every climate. There are fungi that really hold the soil together. Mushrooms, of course, are the fruiting bodies of fungi, but plants rely on fungi for nutrition, and they also rely on fungi for defense. I'm reading what he's writing about this. He's an exciting writer, and it's a lot of fun. He talks about leafcutter ants feeding leaf parts to fungi because the leafcutter ants need the fungi to help them survive. And I think now we may have him with us. Merlin, are you there?
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. Oh.
Great.
Well, I'm really pleased to have you here, and I don't know if you heard what I said in the beginning, but I really enjoyed your book, and the introduction alone, those 20 pages, I thought were worth the price of the book alone. it was an exciting introduction to fungi. Do you ever think a book about fungi would get so much attention? And I know it's gotten a lot of rave reviews.
I'm surprised, to be honest. I mean, I find fungi fascinating and all that they do, but I often thought of it as something that I was nerding out about that others might not, that the respectable civilians might not want to read a whole book about. So I've been pleasantly surprised.
You have to be. Was that a goal? Was that a goal to get people enthused about? And I said fungi. Do you pronounce it fungi or fungi?
You can say what you like. Some people say fungi, some people say fungi, and some people say fungi. I tend to say fungi, but there's no hard and fast.
So fungi is okay.
Fungi is just fine, yeah.
Okay, well, I'm just wondering about the goal. Was it to just build excitement in fungi?
And to open people's eyes to this extraordinary world that's taking place around us, and which creates the conditions for us to live on a day-to-day basis, and to have evolved on an evolutionary timescale. That was an intention, was to try and pull back some of the layers that conceal these organisms and the astonishing things they do.
Yeah, and I said the fungi produce 50 megatons of spores every year. That alone, my eyes just opened up, you know, the weight of 500,000 blue whales. Oh, my goodness. And without them, without fungi, we probably wouldn't be around, would we?
No, we wouldn't be around. And much of what we think of as life wouldn't be around either. And they really are world makers.
Yeah, well, let's get some definitions out of the way maybe first. Maybe tell us about the difference between fungi, mushrooms, and lichens, for example.
So mushrooms are just the reproductive structures of fungi. Most fungi live most of their lives as mycelium, which is a network of branching, fusing cells. And so most fungi actually don't produce mushrooms at all. It's just a minority of fungi that do. So when we're seeing a mushroom, we're seeing just a small part of the lifetime of a small fraction of the fungal world. So that's mushroom and mycelium. Lichens are symbiotic organisms formed when fungi and bacteria or algae come together to create organisms which can photosynthesize like plants, but which also have characteristics of the fungus, and they can live in very extreme environments.
And maybe talk a bit more about what happens below ground. How do they do what they do?
Well, it's a good question. Fungi live at these mycelial networks. They're enmeshed with their surroundings. It's how fungi feed. So fungi have to put their bodies inside their food. It's rather unlike us. And we have to put food inside our bodies. And these networks are how fungi are able to do that. So fungi are always insinuating themselves with their surroundings. They're always bound up in such intimate contact with their surroundings that it's actually very difficult to think about what a fungus is doing without thinking about where it's doing it and who is it doing it with. And so when we think about fungi, we also have to think about their environments, think about their context. And so it's one of the fun things about fungi is that they lead us into an ecological perspective, a way of thinking about relationships and the connections between organisms.
I certainly would agree with that. You write, let's take truffles. Truffles come up in maybe even your first chapter. I can't remember. You went on a truffle hunt in Italy, which was really cool, actually, as you described that. But why the heck are they? To talk about why they're so expensive and what kind of what they are.
Truffles are the reproductive structures of certain types of fungus, so they're equivalent to mushrooms, but they don't look like mushrooms. They look like rather unglamorous clods of fungus, which are underground. They don't stick up above the soil. But because fungi are using them to spread their spores, which are loosely equivalent to plants' seeds, the fungus needs these truffles to be found by an animal. It's part of their evolutionary strategy. But animals going around their business in the forest are not likely to stumble on one of these things by accident. So what the truffle fungi have evolved to do is produce pungent, captivating odors, which find their way through centimeters of damp soil and then drift up into the forest air, and are so captivating that they're able to distract animals from whatever they happen to be doing and persuade the animals to go and dig up this truffle and eat it. So when humans are incorporating truffles into our gastronomic processes and rituals, we're doing very much what the truffle intended, if you'll forgive the intentionality there. We're playing our part in the evolutionary story of the truffle. And so when we delight in a truffle's flavor, we're just one of a number of animals that will also delight in a truffle's flavor. Dogs, pigs, shrews, squirrels, mice, and many others.
And when you were hunting them, you were hunting with some expert people, and they had expert dogs. Some trained, to search out white truffles, and others to search out brown truffles, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, so the dogs are key companions for truffle hunters because they're able to sniff out these truffles and go and find them. Unlike pigs, which were used to be used, the dogs are easier to persuade not to eat the truffles that they find. But the dogs have to be trained to find these truffle smells. Some dogs just do it naturally, but for these hunters in Italy that I was with, they're production hunters, so they really want to have dogs specialized on a particular type of truffle.
And they're so expensive. The dogs are probably expensive too, but the truffles, I guess, although it depends, I think as you say in your book, it depends on the climate or what kind of year it is, probably like anything else.
Yeah, there's supply and demand. So in a dry year, there'll be fewer truffles and the price will go up. But they always tend to be quite expensive for most of the time, and particularly the Italian white truffle, Tuber magnatum. And that's one of the reasons is because it's very hard to cultivate it. Other types of truffle, people have worked out some ways to cultivate them. It's still a hit and miss compared to the humans' more ancient agricultural practices. But the fact that you can at least try to cultivate them means that they're more reliably produced. The white truffle has to be found in the wild, and that means there's much more pressure on truffle hunters, and there's much less supply, which increases the demand.
Yeah. Are they found in, you were in Italy, are they found throughout the world? At least, probably not throughout the entire world, but...
Truffles are found, different types of truffle are found throughout the entire world. There are around 1,000 species of truffle in, or more than 1,000 species of truffle in North America alone. And many of them aren't delicious. I was talking to a truffle expert in Oregon, and he described some truffles that smell like what he described as baby diarrhea. His wife won't let them bring them in the house, even for taxonomic purposes. His dogs love them.
The dog loved them? Oh, yeah, I knowing dogs, the dogs I know at least, they'd love them. They'd eat anything. Merlin Sheldrake is our guest today, biologist and the author of this fascinating book. It's called Entangled Life, subtitle How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Futures. Questions, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Let's take a call. Kenneth in Janesville, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I always thought that as far as the evolution of life goes, to back up a little bit, that fungi came first, but how could this be? And are not our brains a giant fungus?
Hmm. Interesting. What do you think, Merlin?
Well, our brains aren't really a giant fungus. Fungi are their own kingdom of life. That's as broad a category as animals or plants. So we are related to fungi, and in fact more closely related to fungi than we are to plants. But our brains are made up of animal cells, and they're part of an animal body. And there are similarities on a superficial level. Our brains are made up of complex networks of tip-growing cells, and fungal mycelium is also a complex network of tip-growing cells. But I wouldn't say that the analogy goes further than that. But when it comes to the evolution of life, fungi have just played a very important role in the evolution of all sorts of organisms that we depend on, and that the entire terrestrial biosphere depends on. And green plants are an example of that. What we think of as plants were Their ancestors were algae living in freshwater lakes and rivers. And as they started to wash up onto the shores, they partnered with fungi, and the fungi helped them to digest the nutrients in this new solid ground that the algae found themselves on. So the whole history of land plants is a history of the relationship between fungi and algae. And we come to that story significantly later than that.
Hmm. Merlin Sheldrake, our guest, his book, Entangled Life. I'm Larry Mueller. Trina LaSousa and Tyler Dinner, our engineers today. Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Merlin Sheldrake, his book titled Entangled Life. It's all about fungi, however you want to pronounce it. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Vern in Menominee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry and Merlin. I have been to the Barro Colorado Sassoni Institute in Panama. I grew up there, actually.
Very cool. Maybe you could tell us more about about that institute.
That's interesting to hear. It's a fantastic place. I was excited to arrive there and was excited to spend as much time there as I did. It's a research institute where scientists from all over the world come to study these tropical ecosystems, and I found the communities of researchers there as diverse as the forest they'd come to study. There were people who followed the monkeys to study their feeding behaviors. Some people studied the way that beetles navigated. Some people studied bumblebees. Others butterflies. And some people studied the way that lightning struck trees. It was a really fascinating place to be. And there's a kind of bravery, you know, in being a field biologist. When you're a lab biologist, you have quite a lot of control over the fragments of life that you're studying. But when you're a field biologist, it's like you're in the test tube. You're in the world that you're also studying. And I mean, it just makes things a little more difficult as a scientist. It's harder to keep things controlled. And trees fall on your experiments, and anteaters stumble by and disturb your apparatus in the forest. And so there's a kind of humility that comes with field biology, and I really learned to respect that.
And you kind of need to watch out maybe for snakes or whatever else that might harm you too while you're
That's
out
true.
There.
Don't forget the snakes.
Yeah, don't forget them. Oh, thank you, Vern. Mark in Madison, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Well, hi. I have a question about DNA in soils and the way it can be stored and exchanged between organisms. I understand that humic substances tend to stabilize DNA fragments, and that this is, in a sense, a DNA library in soils, which I know that bacteria can exchange genetic material. What about fungi, and do they have any role in this DNA content of soils?
Yes, so fungi make up a large amount of the living, of the biomass of soils, between a third to a half of soil biomass, that is, the mass of the living organisms in the soil, can be made up of fungi. And so they produce, you know, if you took a pinch of soil and extracted all the DNA, then a considerable proportion of that might be fungal. And so, bacteria can exchange DNA. They do it all the time in a process called horizontal gene transfer. Fungi do it less frequently, but they certainly do it. And there are a few notable cases in the history of fungal biology, where they have acquired major metabolic traits by passing DNA between them.
Thanks very much, Mark. Appreciate that call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. You know, this whole business, an earlier caller talked about brain or, you know, do mycelia have brains, well, not in the same sense as you were talking about. There's some sort of electrical signaling that may go on among these. Talk about the research relating to that.
Yeah, so one of the things with fungi, and thinking about fungi and trying to understand their lives, is how do they communicate with themselves? How do they stay in touch with themselves? These networks can sprawl over very large areas, and this whole organism, though not having a defined shape a body plan in the way that we think of ourselves as having a body plan, they still need to stay in touch with them. They need to behave as a coordinated whole, as a single organism. And so the question of how they do that has long puzzled researchers. And then a Swedish biologist in the 90s found, using techniques from modern neuroscience, that some fungal species conducted electrical impulses along their cells through their networks, analogous to those electrical impulses that travel in our own nervous systems. And these impulses seem to respond to stimuli from the environment. So this is a fascinating course of study, which suggests that that fungal networks do indeed use electrical signaling as a way to communicate with themselves, and potentially, although this hasn't been shown, with other organisms.
You know, I was amazed at to read about the way that fungi can solve problems, labyrinths. Tell us about this research or what the work that's been done there.
So there are fascinating studies where researchers have made microscopic labyrinths and allowed fungi to grow through these labyrinths. And there's an entrance, there's an exit, and there's a tortuous, convoluted possibility, mess of possibilities in between. So what the fungi tend to do is, confronted with a forked path, they don't choose one or the other as we would. They can branch and take both routes at once. And as they do this, they fill up the maze. And after a while, they will die back to on certain of those pathways. And they will produce a connection between the entrance and the exit, which is the shortest possible path between those points. So this is a way, in a sense, they can solve these labyrinths and do so in a very different way to the way that we would do it. We'd have to try all these paths and compare the lengths and then decide which was the shortest one, and they can do all that at once. And when you think about it, it makes sense they should be able to do this. Fungi have evolved to live in very confined, enormously complicated environments in the soil. And the soil is not just some homogeneous mass. It's a wild place filled with electrically charged cavities, all sorts of complex, irregular structures, different kinds of creature and material. And the fungus has to distribute itself through this wildly complex environment and keep revising its body as it explores. And in that sense, they are maze dwellers, and the mazes that humans provide them with in the lab are gross simplifications of the kind of thing they're doing right now as we speak.
Yes, I had a big laugh out of one of the researchers who was always having trouble when he visited IKEA to find the exit.
Oh, yeah. This was a friend. He was actually working with slime molds, which are also networked organisms, not quite, not true fungi, but they behave in many similar ways. And yeah, he made a maze for his slime molds modeled on the ground plan of his local IKEA, which he'd always get lost in. He'd have to have attendants show him the way to the exit. But the slime molds, when he unleashed them in his IKEA store maze, were able to find their way to the exit in record time, and he would laugh and suggest that they were cleverer than him. And in some sense, they might be.
In some sense, they might be, absolutely. You say at some point that the biological, I'm going to get a quote here, and I'm not sure if you were quoting someone else, I can't remember now, but you say the biological identity of most organisms can't be pried apart from their microbial symbionts.
Yes. So in biology right now, there's for the last few years, there's been an increasing awareness of the role that microbes, microscopic organisms, play in the lives of larger organisms like us, like other animals, like plants, and fungi as well, large macroscopic fungi. And many of these are bacteria. And so we wouldn't we wouldn't be able to do the things we do, behave in the way that we behave, without the quadrillion microbes that live in and on us, that guide our behaviors, that that shape our immune systems. And so, and we're not alone. All organisms depend on their microbial symbionts. Even bacteria can have smaller bacteria living inside them. Larger viruses can have smaller viruses living inside them, and bacteria full of viruses, as are we. So this is really a kind of Russian doll situation, life within life within life. And it's just like that all the way down. And so that's what I meant in that quote, that when we think about organisms, we're really thinking about these collectives, these whole ecosystems walking around.
And you say at some point we have more microbes, I'm going to get this right, than we actually have in us or on us than we have cells in our body.
Well, we carry around more microbial cells than our own cells.
That's what I, yeah.
And so, of course, this raises the question of, well, what is us if we are a collective of our own cells and microbial cells? All this kind of question about identity, about autonomy, about independence, these are the kinds of issues raised by these microbial findings. And so I think it's a very exciting part of the modern field of biology.
Wisconsin's the dairy state, and I noted one thing. You said cows can't eat grass, but their microbial population can.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, cows would not be able to process grass in the way they do without their vast communities of microbes. And it's their microbes, indeed, who are really doing the eating. The cows just absorbing.
Well, let's talk about some other parts of the book. And the maybe I should go back and ask you just to explain how you've organized the book. And I should have probably done that right away in the beginning, but what the heck? Well, let's do it now.
So I tried to range through a whole variety of fungal of fungi and fungal behaviors and fungal habits. And there are so many ways to think about fungi and so many angles to take. And it's quite difficult actually to chart a course through. And I couldn't hope to be comprehensive in what I present in this book. But I feel like there's a journey. And the journey starts with truffles. And truffles are as a kind of lure that pull you underground. And then I talk about fungal behaviors as mycelial networks. How do they work as networks? How do these networks organize themselves? And how do they associate with other networks and other organisms? And then we move into the theme of symbiosis, of lichens and plants and mycorrhizal fungi and the whole vegetal world and how this emerges from fungal relationships. And then I get into humans and human relationships with fungi through the subject of psychedelics and the ways that these fungal compounds have shaped human identity and belief and cultures for a very, very long time. And then into ways that fungi and humans are striking up new kinds of partnership to help us address some of the big challenges that we face today and moving forwards.
I tell you, your chapter on radical mycology, I found that really, really interesting. Well, just to begin with, you found yourself, you start the chapter by saying, I find myself naked and in a mound of decomposing wood chips in California.
Yeah, I was being, I went to a fermentation bath, which was a really amazing experience. It's an old Japanese practice. There's one such bath in California, and you're buried in decomposing wood chips. And these wood chips have been inoculated with a bacterial culture, but nonetheless are also partly being decomposed by fungi. And the decomposition is a kind of combustion. You know, it's a kind of combustion, but it's a chemical combustion rather than thermal combustion. But it produces a lot of heat. And so when you have these damp wood chips in a big bath, it's steaming hot. And when you go inside that and buried up to your neck, it's like being in a cross between a sauna and a bath. And it's really quite a powerful experience. I was very grateful to be able to go there.
to be able to do it. But then you go on to talk about the amazing things that mycelia can do. At one point you talk about some experiment. It took mycelium about a week to figure out how to break down glyphosate or Roundup.
Yes, so a radical mycologist called Peter McCoy did an experiment where he exposed some oyster mushroom mycelium to drops of glyphosate, and some strains would grow through the glyphosate immediately, breaking it down as this food source. Other strains would grow up to the edge of the drop and wait there for a little while, and then eventually, after a week or so, they seemed to have worked out how to break it down, and then they'd grow through and digest it. Others never worked out how to do that. And it illustrates that point. And fungi are able to, they're able to digest all sorts of unexpected compounds. They can dig deep into their genomes and produce enzymes, which allow them to decompose these tough components of their environment. But a lot of the time, they need exposure to these compounds in order to be able to produce these enzymes. And that's what Peter found in this glyphosate experiment.
Well, there are some implications in terms of, even something like glyphosate, but also pollution and other hazardous things that affect us in this world. And they can play a role, certain ones can play a role in ameliorating those problems.
Yeah, so fungi have voracious appetites for all sorts of compounds, including some compounds that are terrible pollutants for us, which include polyaromatic hydrocarbons like those you find in used cigarette butts, or crude oil from oil spills. They can absorb heavy metals, and so there's a field called mycoremediation where people are working out how we can work with these fungal appetites to help us to deal with some of these big problems in the environment. There's still a lot of work to be done, and fungi can break down these things in the lab in many cases, but it's not so easy to extrapolate to the field. If you could put a fungus in just a pile of a contaminated soil, there are going to be so many other organisms there also doing their thing that it's not necessarily the case that your favored strain will outcompete them and break down your pollutant. But it's a fascinating field of study and one with enormous promise.
Yeah, it does indeed have promise. Gene in Mount Horeb wondered if you could talk about fungal infections and why they seem to be on the rise in the world, at least in her mind.
Yeah, so they are on the rise, new types of fungal infection. And the main reason is that there are more immunocompromised people around these days than there used to be. And that's because of drugs that we give people to lower, to reduce their immune system. And this might be deliberate in the case of immunosuppressants for organ transplants, or other kinds of immune disorders, or it might be a byproduct of other treatments. If, for example, the steroids used to reduce inflammation also reduce the activity of the immune system and make people vulnerable to fungi that would otherwise not be a problem. So this is a big reason that we're seeing a rise of some of these fungal superbugs.
And thinking about, you mentioned some of the medical things related to this. When I think about penicillin, some of the statins, those and others come from, actually there's something, a cyclosporin. Which actually makes transplants possible, does it not?
Yeah, that's one of these immunosuppressants that allow people to undergo organ transplants and receive these organs from other beings into their bodies.
So, what is the research that you have in mind now for the future? I mean, what are you working on, and what do you plan to work on?
Well, there are so many fascinating paths to take with fungi. There are so many open questions, and it's an exciting field of study. I personally am interested in researching more about mycelial communication. How do different types of fungi stay in touch with themselves? How do they use different types of signaling to coordinate their behavior? And how would this help us understand in new ways the ecosystems that we live within? There's a lot of work that's been going on recently to do with the way that fungi connect plants together underground in shared overlapping networks, and material can even pass between plants this way. And so it becomes really important for us to understand how these How are these fungal networks able to coordinate these interconnections? How are they able to grow between different organisms, mediate different types of trade, and behave in the way that they do? Mm-hmm. So I'm very interested in these questions, although there's so much to ask about the fungal world that it's somehow sometimes very hard to decide.
And as you point out in the book, I mean, there's billions of dollars that go into study of plants. There's billions or hundreds of millions of dollars that go into the study of animals. But when it comes to fungi, there's not as much. And there should be. After reading your book, I feel like there should be more money spent on this.
Absolutely. Yeah, fungi are neglected relative to animals or plants. And one of the reasons is that they were thought to be plants until the 60s when they won their independence, taxonomically speaking. And that meant that a lot of the history of modern biology evolved around the concept of fungi being a kind of lower plant that was studied in the unglamorous corners of plant sciences departments. And rather than being a whole kingdom of its own, worthy of a kingdom's worth of attention, funding, students, professorships, and all the rest. So this is one of the reasons, I think. There are a number of other reasons, but thankfully this is starting to change with the campaigning and the careful, diligent efforts of many fungal scientists and mycologists. And thankfully, we're seeing fungi start to become recognized by some organizations and in some contexts as on an equal footing with animals and plants.
Well, I tell you, your book is certainly going to raise the interest among many people. As we kind of wind up today, I loved your epilogue. And you said you were going to do two things with two of your books. Maybe briefly explain what you were going to do, and then I want to know, did you do it?
Yes. So the first thing is to grow oyster mushrooms on one of the copies of the book. So that's actually happened. The oyster mushroom mycelium grows around, it eats the book, it eats the pages of the book, it eats the covers of the book, and then sprouts mushrooms. And then I ate the mushrooms so that I could eat my words.
And, I love that.
And they were delicious. They were really delicious. I couldn't taste any off notes. And it was a fine experience. And then the other thing, which I have to say I'm still working on, was to break down the cellulose in the pages of the book into sugars, and then ferment the sugars into alcohol, and then make a beer or a wine from the book, and then drink it. And this is somewhat more complicated, and I'm still optimizing the protocols, but it is a work in progress, and I'll happily report back when I get this all together.
I would love to have you report back. And that other chapter you had, another chapter that you had on yeasts and beer and wine, I mean, is absolutely fascinating. Well, I hope we do have a chance to talk again. Merlin, are you working on another book already, or are you...
No, I'm taking a break from books. I'm excited to get back and do some science.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it. I loved your book. Thank you. Merlin Sheldrake, our guest. His book, it's an exciting book. Believe me, it is. Entangled Life is the title. And the subtitle is How Fungi Make Our Worlds, Change Our Minds, and Shape Our Future. And I know you're going to like it. I hope you take a look at it. And I think you're going to like I'm pretty sure you're going to like what's coming up next, because we're going to switch into the world of kayaking and canoeing and talk about doing that in the fall with Darren Bush. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to the Ideas Network.